with Susan Kianpo. I'm Aya Oswald from the Chairwell.
I'm Ishwan. I'm from Human Rights Talk and Oxid.
And Suzanne is a BBC Emmy-winning journalist who's been, we've just learned, has been to over 60 countries and reported across a huge range of subjects. And we're really excited to ask her a few questions about her career in journalism and her thoughts on the current state of the world. So I'm going to start out by asking a couple of questions about your background in journalism. So as a young person, you were interested in politics and international relations. How did you sort of decide on journalism as the best way of expressing your political voice?
So I was actually told to never tell this story by one of my bosses, which is exactly why I'm going to tell it. So when I was in about fourth grade, I don't know what that is in UK school standards, but I was about 9 or 10. We had Current Affairs Friday, and so we had an assignment every Friday where we had to go and take a newspaper, which you guys are probably do not actually use a paper newspaper anymore, but we would have to go and take a newspaper and find an article and clip it up and summarize it, like handwrite a summary of the article, and then present it in front of the class. And I loved Fridays, specifically because I got to look forward to this. And I basically do this for a living now. So yeah, that's kind of like admitting that TV journalists take newspaper journalism and just present it, and they do all the work. But yeah, I mean, all jokes aside, I grew up during an era of a lot of conflict. I grew up in America, and so I specifically remember reading Time magazine for kids and the Kosovo War happening, and the US kind of emerged victorious as like a kind of savior who, Bill Clinton actually, who went to school here. He went to UNIV, which is where I was a student at, and actually on our first day they showed us his dorm. But yes, yeah, so I, as a young person, I was constantly surrounded by journalism and specifically conflict, like news about conflict. Like I even have a very vivid memory of being a small child watching the evening news of the invasion during the first Gulf War, and asking my relatives at the time to explain me what was happening. And I thought this was like the early 90s, so I was pretty small. And then obviously the 9/11 happened. And I just started high school. So it was fall of September 2001, I just started high school. And I was in gym class with my classmates, and suddenly we all gathered around the TV. And back then it was like these TV boxes on carts that usually if they rolled this in to class, it meant the teacher's just having a day and doesn't really want to teach, and we're just like watching the news or watching a movie. Anyway, we're all gathered around the TV and we're watching the Twin Towers come down and we have no idea what's happening. And I live, or my school was right next to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. And so after that, the biggest concern was biological warfare. Was there going to be an attack on the CDC? And so we were having to do drills going into the bomb shelter. And so then 2 years after that, George Bush invades Iraq. So I was just completely surrounded by the news and news about conflict. And so I ended up studying conflict and security. And then when I came here, when I was studying here, the 777 attack happened. So it's just followed me. And I just realized how important documenting history is and how important being an impartial witness to documenting that history is. And that's really what drove my decision to go into this part of journalism. And of course, you know, I was just getting started in journalism, and that's when the Arab Spring happened and then the rise of ISIS. My first real foreign posting was quiet. It was in Lebanon, and it was, when I arrived, it was quiet, and then suddenly, next thing you know, there's this Islamic extremist group that is wreaking havoc across the region, and they're chopping heads off an hour away from where I was living in Beirut. So, long answer to your short question.
How has the world of journalism changed since the time when you came into it?
So much. So when I first started, there, at least in television journalism, you know, there was a kind of, in the US, there were the three main networks and then the three main cable channels. And now there are so many outlets. And it seems like every day somebody's starting a new news outlet, and it's great. And then like there's a whole other ecosystem when it comes to social media and new social media outlets coming up, which can be, I see the upside in that. There's obviously downsides, but I see the upside in that, you know, particularly in my work, it has never been easier for sources and contacts to get in touch with journalists. So I see that as a really good thing. I think when I first started at journalism, the US economy was like the worst recession since the Great Depression. And so, my family thought I was crazy because I just graduated from university and my education was pretty expensive in the US. And so they're thinking, oh great, she's gonna go and get this great high paying job. And then I called them, I said, guys, I have a job. I'm working at NBC News, which is, that's like working for the BBC here. And I said, oh, that's wonderful, what are you doing? I said, I am working in the mailroom. I'm delivering mail. What? I said, listen, you have to do anything to get your foot in the door at that time. And I promise it'll work out. And sure enough, a year later, I was following Obama around and meeting Kobe Bryant. And so it did work out, it led me here. But at that time, I didn't have as many options. Like I had to do it what I could. And now, students interested in journalism have so many options. And the world is really your oyster. And also, I think, with the emergence of AI, I shouldn't say it's the emergence of AI, artificial intelligence. Obviously, it's been around for a while. But I think with the sophistication that we're seeing that exists, I think the media landscape is going to change even more. And I personally think it's a positive development. Others might not agree, but.
How do you see the role of journalists changing with AI?
I think that actually, the reason why I think it's a good thing is I think people will pay for good content, and they're, because of this fear of AI, there's less room for mediocrity. I mean, everyone has to be on their game. Everyone has to be thinking creatively. You need to be thinking about what you can deliver to your audience that a robot can't. It's really as simple as that. And people will pay for good content. They don't need to be afraid of AI. Like, the AI is not going to take all of our jobs. I think it's going to take jobs that keep us from being able to do our jobs in the way that we really want to. I mean, I really see it as helping with the busy work, frankly. And I say that as somebody who hosted an episode of the BBC's Inquiry, which was all about killer robots and the rise of AI in warfare, and I still am optimistic, so I think that's saying something.
That's good news. You've been to, as we mentioned, many countries and have an extremely broad career. Are you conscious of any sort of change in approach depending on culture, and how do you navigate those shifts between cultures in your journalism?
Yeah, definitely. I actually think that being from a diverse cultural background has been an asset for me. Particularly, my dad's family is Iranian. And so when I've been speaking to, kind of particularly in foreign policy, officials who are not exactly friends with the US, when they've found out that I'm Iranian, there's almost I think there's an element of intrigue, but there's maybe less mistrust. I don't want to say there's trust, because I think that's a stretch depending on, you know, who it is I'm speaking to. I think there's potentially less mistrust. And so that's kind of been helpful on a diplomacy point of view. And then when it comes to kind of human-to-human interaction, particularly in some of the conflict areas where I've reported as a woman, you have better chances of getting the stories of the women who are in the war zones. And oftentimes they have the most profound stories, but they're less likely to open up to men. And usually, this is changing now, but usually traditionally men have been the ones who have been attracted to being war zone reporters, right? So I think that I'm grateful that I've come from a background where I can sort of maneuver depending on where it is that I'm going. But even in the US, I mean, the US is such a complicated place, and some parts of the country just feel like a completely different world to others. And, you know, being from the southern part of the country, when Donald Trump was elected, there were times where when I would approach people when I was doing stories about kind of Trump land, MAGA country, as we would say, they would first see me with a bit of suspicion, because they would say they saw the BBC as a bit of, you know, like an elitist organization like the rest of the media, because Trump was really big on pumping up the whole fake news thing. But then when they would find out that I'm from Georgia, they would soften. And so I think as a journalist, it's good to tap into the parts of what make you who you are and your identity to not only empathize with your subjects, the subjects of your stories, but also be able to, you know, kind of make them feel safe and put them in a position to soften.
And you've done a lot of work in your journalism in sort of uplifting women's voices and finding their stories, which has been really quite inspiring and really fascinating. I was wondering, with the cultural shifts and also across time, have you ever struggled with kind of asserting or demanding your legitimacy in those kinds of political spaces?
Oh yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, however, I've found that sometimes it's good if you're underestimated, because then they're off their game and you can use that to your advantage. So I've taken that to work for me rather than, you know, getting offended by it. And I think like one's work speaks for itself, and it's also one of the reasons why I felt that it was important for particularly women in conflict stories to be amplified. So that was really one of the roots of Women Building Peace, was because I was going to these conflict zones and I was talking to these women and I didn't see them. I didn't see those stories amplified. And there was this UN women statistic that came out pretty shortly before my series debuted on the BBC, and it was that to this day, still, only 25% of stories have women as the subject. This was in early 2022. And yet, women don't make 25% of the world's population. So, I mean, we still have work to do. And I think that actually, I got so much positive feedback after that series launched. And I think representation matters. And so seeing women, amplifying the stories of women, not only in leadership, but also connecting them with women, kind of the younger women, the younger generation in the case of my program, in the conflict zones, and literally facilitating the conversation between two people who would normally not have access to each other, lifts them up. And we need more of that, and I hope to contribute to more of that, and I hope that more women join me in contributing to more of that, and stay tuned.
I think I'll hand over to Ishwan to talk.
So I actually wanted to ask about your views on the protests in Iran. So obviously you've done a lot of reporting on it. Could you just give our listeners a bit of context? So how are they going right now, and what do you think is the future of these protests?
So I just recently published an article in Politico magazine called "The Women of Iran Are Not Backing Down," and that stands. I believe I also ended the article with "This genie is not going back in the bottle," and it's not. This revolution is a revolution, and it is the first women-led revolution, and Iran is no stranger to protests. It's whether it's Iran when it was still a monarchy or Iran as under the rule of the Islamic Republic. But this time, it's led by the women, it's supported by men, and the regime is losing ground, and they know they're losing ground, and therefore they know they have to reform. There are factions within the regime who have admitted this, who are advising the supreme leader. I've had sources tell me this who are directly have knowledge of these conversations, have had the conversations themselves. And when you get to that point, this is why I very confidently say that this genie is not going back in the bottle. And as it stands, the hijab, which is what sparked the protests, has been something that has been being rebelled against for a long time. And in the opening of the article, I talked about my last trip to Iran, which was in 2007. And I even then witnessed how, and I mean, me and my cousin were also part of the rebellion because we were trying to wear as little hijab as possible. I saw how the women were quietly protesting, using fashion, frankly. And they were slowly pulling at the thread of the hijab, which would eventually begin to unravel one of the pillars of the regime. And that is what's happening now. And they know that, and this is why they're in crisis mode. So I think we have to continue to see how it unfolds, but there is no question. It's not a matter of like change is coming. I mean, change has already, it's happened. Change is in the past, it's already happened. Women are just going out in the streets and they're not wearing hijab. And they're trying to find all these ways to enforce it and enforce the law, basically. And women don't care. The ones who don't want to wear it aren't wearing it, and the ones who do want to wear it are. There's this, some say, oh, you know, it's over because they're not pouring into the streets like they were in the fall. But that's not true. I mean, a revolution isn't something that is you're in the streets marching every single day. That's not what a revolution is. We'll see how it unfolds.
Yeah, I read the article. It was really good. Yeah. I just wanted to pick up on something you said about the women themselves leading the protests. How does that specifically contribute to the longevity of the revolution?
So I think it's a battle of the wills, right? And the authorities are banking on the women giving up. And they're not going to give up, particularly because... And I've had conversations with people who have been non-political for most of their lives and now are suddenly political, because this isn't a political movement. And by political, I mean they're saying we don't want the regime, right? And it's less about politics. It's about civil rights. And the regime really miscalculated, quite frankly, in its crackdown. They thought they would get away with what they've gotten away with in the past. But nobody is forgetting the amount of people who have died. The women, the kids, the men. Nobody's forgetting that. So that doesn't just go away. And so that's why, you know, women continuing to lead the charge. Well, what prompted the protests and what was the sort of match that lit up this? I mean, when you're in the middle, I mean, I've been living in Dubai for like about, part-time at least, it felt like living in a tinderbox in the fall. And I thought, because I also was hosting this documentary on the Iran-Israel shadow war, I thought that it would be a kind of miscalculation in the shadow war, the covert war between Iran and Israel. But it wasn't. It was a routine detention of a woman who wasn't wearing her hijab properly. This is an important distinction. It's not that she wasn't wearing hijab at all. She just wasn't wearing it properly. And they detained her, which happens all the time, and it went wrong. And that was it.
I also wanted to pick up on something in the Women Building Peace series. Mm-hmm. So I listened to the episode on the Colombian peace agreement. I just wanted to ask, what do you think kind of women-centric conflict resolution looks like? And do you think that that's a trend we can expect to continue seeing in the future? Or is it something that's still very tentative?
Well, I hope that we see more of it in the future. I think that Colombia, the reason why we decided to do an episode on Colombia, even though Latin America is largely ignored by the world's media, unless it's, you know, unless it's kind of the classic something going off in Venezuela, at least I'm thinking specifically from American news. That was the perfect example of why women need to be at the table when it comes to peace negotiations. But also, you know, we often speak a lot about women in peace. I did a story about the women of the Iran nuclear deal, the women who were the ones who actually brought home the Iran nuclear deal. But there, I also want to focus on the role of, there's a role for women and power when it comes to building peace. And that's what it really comes down to. There is power and being able to be at a table to bring about peace. And I think up until now, there's been this kind of idea that, oh, you know, let's just like, yeah, like peace building is safe. Let's kind of allow the women to do it. And now we're seeing that actually, oh, this is quite effective. And so I think, again, to go back to the women of Iran, there was a huge coup. This cohort of women who managed to get Iran kicked off the UN Committee for Protection of Women's Rights, which is incredibly ironic. And so that in and of itself is an example of why women should have a seat at this table.
I was actually going to ask you about that coup from the UN. What role do you think international organizations like the UN have to play in these protests? And do you think they've made a significant impact, or what more could they be doing?
I mean, people will debate this and they'll say, well, what did that really mean? Like how much, like it was symbolic, right? But I think particularly when it comes to Iran, so much of the hold on power is psychological. And so that was, psychologically speaking, that was a defeat for the regime. Obviously, when it comes to hands-on approach, what can the UN do? There's a lot of debate around that, particularly around violations of human rights, which is what they're looking at right now in terms of what mechanisms can they use in order to hold the perpetrators of human rights violations in Iran specifically, but also elsewhere in Ukraine also as well, what the UN can do to actually hold these people accountable. But like many bureaucracies, the UN is a bureaucracy, and therefore that's why the efficacy of it as an organization has historically been called into question. I mean, Donald Trump is one of them, right? But then, you know, we see the victories that the women who took this case to the UN and succeeded, we see those as well. So, at the end of the day, everybody is on the same page when it comes to the people who are, whether they're in the diaspora or whether they're inside the country or whether it's the UN or the US government or the UK government, everyone is in agreement that the future of the country lies in the hands of the people living inside the country. I mean, they all kind of live in the shadow of the 1953 coup, which has really been weaponized in a way by the regime to kind of reinforce this idea that, oh, the West is just coming in to meddle. And there's a lot of discrepancies with that story, but it's a separate conversation.
So on the topic of kind of protest more broadly, you recently posted on your socials about social media as a new organizing tool for protest. Mm. Obviously, we saw it in Myanmar as well, where there was attempts to crack down on social media avenues. So what do you think is the role of social media in protests now, and how do you think they'll shape the evolution of protests in the future?
I think I also posted this on my social media that there are days where I'm so sick of social media and I'm just like, why do I have to keep this up? But then I remember why, because it's literally a lifeline for people like the Afghan woman who we called Lama to protect her identity at the time. Now she's out of the country. She's continuing her studies in exile. She's holding UN officials' feet to the fire. And the reason why she made it onto my first episode about Afghanistan and women's education in Afghanistan, where she had a direct conversation with Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton actually just retweeted her the other day, and she's really cute. She's freaking out about it, naturally, as you would. And she contacted me on Twitter. She just DM'd me on Twitter, which is, again, this is like a whole separate thing, but this is why social media is important, verification is important. Elon Musk is throwing all of this up in the air, and there's a lot of debate about this right now, but all of that is important because this is a tool for getting your voice heard. And for the women of Iran, I always say that the 2009 Green Revolution, which was a political movement, and that was all about kind of having the right to free and fair elections in Iran. So that was the Twitter revolution, and that really put Twitter on the map. It was the Iranian revolution, or, you know, political campaign that got Twitter on the map. And then the Arab Spring came after and just sort of solidified it. But this time around, the women's led revolution in Iran is Instagram. It's all Instagram. And so many of the reporting that I've done came from random people just sending me DMs and voice. I mean, I, at one point when the protests were happening every single day and it was really bloody, I was waking up to voice notes every single day. And you know, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have known what was happening in Iran, even though I was 70 kilometers away from it, because I couldn't get in. None of us, they weren't letting Western journalists in. And so social media is a really important tool. I find it as a double-edged sword. And I mean, it's here to stay. It'll evolve, but it's here to stay.
And as more protests kind of take place predominantly on social media, do you think there's any forms of activism on social media that are performative, or is that kind of a distinction that isn't worth drawing?
Yes, I think unfortunately in activism and journalism and all kinds of isms, there's performative. But I mean, I think at the end of the day, when it comes to human rights, it is the journalist's job to sift through the performative. I think performative is inevitable, no matter where you go, and no matter what you're doing, and no matter who you're talking to, it is something that you have to keep in mind that may be a factor that you need to think about.
I also just wanted to ask, and this is kind of bringing in things from Women Building Peace and the articles you've written about the desire of the Iranian people to keep telling their stories. What's the role that storytelling plays in advocacy?
I mean, there was a time where a friend told another friend that they had heard this amazing podcast called Women Building Peace, and it was the Ethiopia episode, and it was so moving that they had to turn into pull over into a driveway and continue listening to it. And so when I hear stuff like that as feedback to the journalism that I've put out into the world, I realize how important storytelling is. It's not just the story, it's also how you tell it. And for me, for Women Building Peace, I found it was of utmost priority to really focus on the stories of the people living the story on the ground, in this case, in the conflict zone. Some of the episodes were post-conflict, as you know, Colombia and Bosnia. But it's about the story and the person and what they've experienced, because also storytelling When you tell your story, there's this quote that now I can't remember who said it, but I love this quote. I think about it often, and I think it's a big part of why I do what I do. It's tell the story of the mountain you climbed, because it could be a page in somebody else's survival guide. And I think that that can resonate across so many different kinds of stories. Joan Didion said we tell ourselves stories in order to survive. I mean, storytelling is so important. And I think it's important to be protected. And that's why I keep doing what I'm doing.
Well, that's all I have now.
And all from me as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.